Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday, the 20th of September, these are our main stories. Across the world, protesters take to the streets ahead of the UN Climate Change Summit. We'll hear from the demonstrators and ask if the politicians will listen to them. Also, Twitter suspends thousands of accounts disseminating Saudi propaganda. And confusion in the Philippines, as rewards for convicts to be returned to prison prove a bit too effective. Also in this podcast,
in midwinter, they cannot reach this ship because the ice will be so thick at that point. So they're going to make a runway next to the ship on the ice and fly in a plane.
A German ship heads off on what's billed as the biggest Arctic science expedition ever. And the member countries of the Commonwealth talk about how to improve the lives of women. Climate change protests are taking place across the world today as people take to the streets to demand urgent action against global warming. The demonstrations began in Sydney with thousands of students walking out of their classrooms. Global 150 countries are hosting rallies with millions of people trying to grab the attention of world leaders preparing for a UN summit on climate change on Monday. As we heard there in Sydney, students are at the forefront of today's demonstrations, which have been inspired by the young Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who's due to address crowds in New York later. Duncan Kennedy has compiled this report.
Home to 7.5 billion people, beautiful but fragile, robust but warming, and today the stage for a global message. The Pacific island of Vanuatu helped send the first of those messages. And no wonder, their low-lying homes could be among the first to disappear if sea levels rise. In Sydney, children also put climate before classroom. Thousands marching with teachers and other workers to call for government action to cut greenhouse gas emissions.
It's vital that young people are at the forefront of this conversation because they will be impacted more than anyone else.
I think this is the most important issue of our time, and I'm here for my children's future. I think it's that important.
This isn't a fringe movement, this isn't a greenie issue, this isn't a lefty issue, this is a human issue.
They have to stop making political advantage of this issue and unite the country behind a crisis approach to dealing with modifying our economy to be carbon free.
The Swedish environmental activist Greta Thunberg later tweeted her support. The new day in South Africa brought singers and dancers onto the streets. Here in Johannesburg, they also wanted to send a message to next week's UN conference on climate change that the speed of action must be increased. In India, the crowd seemed more modest, but in a country whose economy is expanding at around 7% a year, the government has argued growth can exist alongside climate controls.
Action and climate justice.
From Thailand, where this was still a day that found room for humour, to Berlin, where the crowds gathered to demand change. Many governments say they're already taking action in what's being called a policy race to the top. But today's protesters say it's the speed of that ascent that may not be enough.
That report was by Duncan Kennedy. More from our correspondents around the world now. Anne Soy joined demonstrators who'd gathered in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
There are easily hundreds of activists here marching through Nairobi in one of the main streets. They're wearing white, red and black t-shirts, and I can see placards calling for an end to deforestation, preservation of Kenya's water towers, as well as something they're calling decolonization. They're against a government project to exploit coal as a source of energy. I'll speak to some of them.
For a country like Kenya, which is going to be heavily impacted by the industries of other countries, people here need to be pushing and realize that as well.
Save planet Earth. We should stop single-use plastic.
My message is, I want all the children to plant trees.
And from Anne Soy in Nairobi to another of our correspondents, Caroline Davis, who is at the demonstration in central London.
Well, over the past hour or so, we've had plenty of protesters gathering here, many of them with their own homemade placards saying things like, make Earth great again and we can do better. They're expected to be sort of several thousand here today. Obviously, many of them have been students. There are plenty of school children here as well. Many of them university students too. Of course, this is the first time that adults have been asked to join this particular protest as well. The Met Police have already said that they are concerned about disruption in London. They've set conditions saying that the protest must stay within this set area within Westminster and needs to finish around 3:30 p.m. And if protesters don't do this, or they encourage others to ignore this ruling, then they say that they're liable to be arrested. But at the moment, an incredibly positive atmosphere, with almost sort of festival-like, with people cheering each other on.
And is it your sense, talking to people who are gathering for this protest, Caroline, that they think that today's actually going to make any difference?
I think many people are overwhelmed by seeing all of the photographs and images and videos from around the world and other people's messages. They feel like they are part of something that is a bigger movement here. I think that many of them feel very hopeful. Whether or not that will continue and sustain over the course of the next, over the weekend and into the summit next week, it's not certain. But at the moment, particularly at the beginning of the day when everyone is turning out in high spirits, certainly a lot of people feel like this could make a difference.
Caroline Davis in central London. So will the politicians listen? Our environment analyst is Roger Harabin.
The strikes have already had an effect. They've been welcomed by many political figures because they've increased political legitimacy for policies to tackle climate change. Over the weekend, there'll be a sort of market hall at the United Nations, where countries and regional governments and, crucially, industry bosses will show off the techniques they're using to reduce emissions. Then, on Monday, the most inspiring leaders will be invited by the Secretary-General to speak at his climate summit. We've seen this sort of thing from time to time in the past, but three new factors are in play. First, the prominence of young voters demanding change. Then the climate itself, its effects more dramatic and much earlier than many scientists really expected. Then industrial leadership, also influenced by the young strikers who'll become tomorrow's consumers. But as the scientific urgency increases, emissions are still going up.
Our environment analyst Roger Harabin. You can follow this story as it develops in the coming hours by going to the live page, updated every few minutes at bbc.com/news. Twitter has suspended thousands of accounts disseminating Saudi propaganda. These include the account of the former Saudi royal court advisor Saud al-Qahtani, who's suspected in involvement in the killing of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Our Arab Affairs editor Sebastian Usher told me more.
He was a very influential royal court advisor in Saudi Arabia, a close aide and ally of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Now, there hasn't been any tweet on his account for almost a year. That's because of the suspicion that has hung over him since Jamal Khashoggi was murdered. He has been accused of essentially being the man who orchestrated that. Now, the Saudi authorities, with all the global anger and outrage over it, sacked him from his position. It's unclear where he is now or what he's doing. There are reports, rumours that he still is wielding influence from the shadows, but also there have been reports, and I say these very much unconfirmed, that he may actually have been done away with in order to silence him. But as I say, no confirmation of that whatsoever.
And what about the propaganda supposedly being spread around on social media using these accounts?
Well, essentially, Saud al-Qahtani orchestrated, as I say, these media campaigns which were pouring out Saudi propaganda. Now, this is in a whole series of disputes and wars that Saudi Arabia has engaged in under the Crown Prince. So with Qatar, the huge diplomatic row that exploded several years ago now, directly from Saud al-Qahtani's own Twitter account, then followed by thousands and thousands of other tweets, which Twitter says essentially proves that it was bots, that they were automatically generated, also over the Yemen war. So this has been a big concerted effort led by Saud al-Qahtani, which Twitter has decided enough is enough.
Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher. Now, imagine trying to round up thousands of convicts mistakenly freed from prison. That's exactly what's been happening in the Philippines this week. President Duterte ordered the capture of the ex-prisoners who'd committed serious crimes and offered a reward for each wanted person. But the police have now returned more prisoners than originally went missing, and the Justice Department is appealing for them to stop their arrests. As our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me, it's a remarkable story.
Oh, I mean, it all stems back from a massive controversy surrounding one former prisoner, a guy named Antonio Sanchez, who was a former Philippine mayor. He was convicted of rape and multiple murders and sentenced to 360 years in prison. But then it came to light that he was being released after just 24 years because of so-called good behavior. And then it came to light that the government was releasing 11,000 other prisoners because of good behavior. This was a huge embarrassment for President Rodrigo Duterte, who says that he's tough on crime. The government then had to reverse its plans to release some of those prisoners, around 1,900 of them, saying that, oh, wait, they had actually committed quite serious crimes. They needed to come back to prison. And Duterte actually upped the ante, as you said, when he put a $20,000 bounty on the head of each prisoner. He's saying that he wanted them returned dead or alive, preferably dead.
So this tempting reward has resulted in so many people being returned as so-called wanted convicts that they're stopping the system. Do they think that some of the people who've ended up back in prison are the wrong people?
Yeah, well, some prisoners, they were encouraged to turn themselves in. And some people who hadn't been convicted of so-called heinous crimes turned themselves in anyway, simply because they were worried about vigilante groups coming after them to return them to prison to collect this huge amount of money. The police in the Philippines are known for brutality, we've seen during the so-called drug wars. And so, yes, this has really resulted in sort of mass confusion in the Philippines. Today, the Minister of Justice appealed to the police to stop arresting convicts. But then we had on the same day the spokesperson for the same justice ministry saying only President Duterte can order the police to stop.
Our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. This year's Mercury Music Prize has been awarded to the British rapper Dave. The Mercury is an annual award for what's judged to be the best music album from the previous year, recorded by an act from the UK or Ireland. Dave is 21 and a Londoner from a Nigerian family. More from our arts correspondent, Vincent Dowd.
Dave's first album is about psychoanalysis and counselling.
What do you think people see when they look at you?
You see our gold chains and our flashy cars. I see a lack of self-worth and I see battle scars. He has to be with 20 men when he wears jewellery. And you see it as gangster, I see it as insecurity where I'm from.
David Omoregi is a 21-year-old rapper from South London. With producer Fraser Smith, he's taken grime, a specifically London brand of rap, strong on social comment, and he's stretched it. His first album, Psychodrama, which has won the award, had excellent reviews when it came out. It focuses on the singer's own mental well-being and then looks more widely at what a white-dominated society expects of young black British men in particular. His own brother is serving a long prison sentence for involvement in a murder, and accepting the prize, Dave spoke of that.
I want to thank my brother Christopher that inspired this album. This is your story that we told. And even though you can't be here with us today, I know you're watching this, bro, and I'm so grateful. Thank you guys so much.
Black is beautiful, black is excellent.
Black is pain, black is joy, black is evident.
Dave's performance at the ceremony last night in London delighted the live audience. Psychodrama wasn't the only one of the 12 shortlisted albums to deal in politics and real-world problems. It's a hard-hitting piece, but that clearly was what the Mercury judges were looking for. Black is all I know, there ain't a thing that I would change in it.
Our arts correspondent Vincent Downed reporting. You're listening to Global News with the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main stories and why they matter. That's in our programme The World This Week, and Max Pearson is here to tell us what's on the latest edition.
Well, the attack on Saudi oil installations this past week has clearly upped the ante in a volatile region. We'll look at how exposed the kingdom is, whether Iran, which is accused of being behind the attacks, is at risk of a military response from the US, and indeed what are the constraints on President Trump. Also, we've had a shift in European policy towards migrants coming to the continent. We'll examine that. We've got a good news story. Child mortality rates around the world are falling dramatically. Why? And India has more than 19,000 languages spoken by its people. There's been a suggestion that everyone should just speak Hindi. Controversial? You bet.
Thanks, Max. That's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website at bbc.com/programmes. Still to come in this edition of our own podcast.
Dozens of species caught from the forests to supply the trade are disappearing from the wild. And scientists studying this say it's now reached a tipping point.
How the demand for pet birds across the world is fueling an extinction crisis. Let's return now to the subject of climate change. As we record this podcast, a German research ship is due to set off on what's being described as the biggest Arctic scientific expedition ever. The vessel will embed itself in the sea ice and drift for a whole year to study all aspects of the climate system. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos told me more.
The Arctic at the moment is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the planet. We know that. We can see that in the Arctic sea ice, the way that it's declining very rapidly. In the next few days, scientists will announce that the Arctic sea ice has reached its second lowest minimum extent in the satellite record. So we can see what's taking place there. When we look at our computer models to try, though, and project to the future, it's very uncertain. And one of the reasons for that is that we don't really understand the processes that are taking place up there, the way the atmosphere interacts with the ocean, with the ice. And so we need that data to have a better idea of what future climate change in the Arctic is going to be like. And that's important because we're already starting to see the changes up there kind of start to disrupt the weather patterns at mid-latitudes.
And how is this mission going to deliver that data?
Well, they're going to take hundreds of scientists with their experiments to go and gather that kind of data that they can put into the computer models.
These are clearly scientists who are going to be working in very harsh conditions. Have they had to take supplies for the entire mission with them?
So this is an enormous logistical effort. It's taken 10 years to put together. So not only is it an icebreaker, but it needs the support of other icebreakers as well. So the Russian, the Chinese, the Swedes are all doing that. But in midwinter, they cannot reach this ship because the ice will be so thick at that point. So they're going to make a runway next to the ship on the ice and fly in a plane. If that doesn't work, they'll use long-range helicopters. But that may not work also. But the hole is big enough in the polar stern that they'll get through for a couple of months, 2 or 3 months, if the supplies don't arrive at them.
Our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos. The Commonwealth, which comprises 53 nations with links to Britain, is meeting in Kenya this week to discuss ways to speed up efforts to improve opportunities for women. They'll be handed a report published today which shows there's been some progress. For example, in 13 Commonwealth member countries, 30% or more of members of parliament are women. Baroness Scotland is the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations. Dan Damon asked her about the report's key findings.
One of the main things we were looking at is whether gender equality has actually changed. And we've seen that in many areas it has. But one of the things that we've identified are the areas where it hasn't changed quickly enough. And that area is about violence against women, particularly in relation to domestic violence. And we are looking at the type of issues which will need to change more quickly. So, for example, many of our countries have made significant progress on representation of women in parliament and representation of women in the workforce. But we've looked at the figures for our 53 countries. You know that there are 53 countries in the Commonwealth, 2.4 billion people, 60% of whom are under the age of 30. So we are a real microcosm, if you like, a petri dish of the whole world. And what we think is so important about this report is it digs deep into what has worked, what hasn't, and what we could perhaps do together to make sure that the progress that a number of our member states have made could be accelerated and shared with others who aren't moving quite so quickly.
Is there a danger that those countries that are most democratic, that have recognised the importance of changing policies, equal pay and those things, that those countries get more scrutiny than those who seem to be hopeless cases in some of them in the Middle East, some of them in sub-Saharan Africa, where the status of women seems to have been frozen in a past time?
Well, I think the thing to remember is that the Commonwealth family have a great deal in common. We speak the same language, we have the same common law, we have similar institutions. And therefore, the good thing is, if we can work out what works for one of us, we have a really good chance of replicating that in other countries. And the thing we know is that changing the law is only the first step. We really have to work hard on implementation. And the question is, how do you deliver that? A number of countries, for instance, have made real changes in terms of domestic violence legislation. But we have discovered that unless you back that up with training in relation to the different elements, whether it's police, judiciary, working with medics in hospitals, in local authorities, the sort of change that we need to see doesn't actually happen.
Baroness Scotland, the Secretary General of the Commonwealth of Nations, with my colleague Dan Damon. Bird populations in North America and Asia are in crisis, according to two major studies. Scientists in the US and Canada have found a loss of 3 billion birds, 30% of the population, in 50 years. And in Asia, there's talk of a tipping point in what's being dubbed the songbird crisis. On the Indonesian island of Java, more birds now live in cages than in the wild. Our science reporter Victoria Gill has been finding out more in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta.
This is Pramuka Market. It is the largest wildlife market in Asia, possibly in the world, and it is crammed to the gills with caged birds.
There can be more than 16,000 birds for sale here in a single day, more than 200 different species. In Java, Indonesia, the songbird trade is thriving. It's fueled by a national passion for birdsong. Singing competitions like this take place all over the country every weekend. But it's also driving an extinction crisis. Dozens of species caught from the forests to supply the trade are disappearing from the wild. And scientists studying this say it's now reached a tipping point.
Java is an island around the size of England. And we found through household interviews that around 75 million birds are kept in cages in captivity in people's houses. Now that's a huge number, but to put it into perspective, we also need to look at the wild populations, and we know they're declining severely. Rare birds are going extinct, but we're also losing those common birds from the wider environment, and that is a big problem. These are birds like robins and blue tits and blackbirds. We should be able to hear them, but in Java we can't, and that is a very serious problem.
This is one of two major studies published today that point to a global crash in bird populations. The other, a project carried out by scientists in the US and Canada, examined 50 years of bird surveys in North America. It revealed that there are 3 billion fewer birds in the continent today than there were in 1970. Habitat loss, driven by human activity, has been blamed. But the researchers are actually optimistic that their conclusions could be a wake-up call, triggering action to protect vital habitats and migration routes. And in Indonesia, the widespread love of birds could provide a catalyst for them to be protected in the wild.
Our science reporter, Victoria Gill. The international home rental giant Airbnb says it plans to list its shares next year in a move that would make it one of the most high-profile names on the New York Stock Exchange. But investors will be hoping that Airbnb fares better than another gig economy giant Uber, whose share value dropped significantly after it went public. From New York, here's Vivian Nunes.
Well, I think Airbnb sees itself as different to Uber and Lyft in the fact that it's a company that is making a profit. We know for a three-month period earlier this year, Airbnb brought in revenue of $1 billion. So it was also privately valued a couple of years ago at $31 billion. Airbnb is actually in 100,000 cities around the world. It has been expanding in the fact that it's been offering experiences as well as homes for rent on its site. But it has come into problems. It's run up against city authorities in some of the biggest cities of the world, like Paris, Berlin, Amsterdam. They say that Airbnb has brought up house prices, it's taken away housing stock or brought up rental prices. And so there's also a debate going on here in New York, actually, between city authorities and Airbnb. Investors will want to see that cleared up before Airbnb lists, presumably on one of the stock exchanges here in New York.
Vivian Nunes. That's almost it from this edition of the Global News podcast. But before we go, it's time for our weekly roundup of some of the less reported stories from around the world. This is News from Elsewhere, and I'm joined by Martin Morgan from BBC Monitoring. So firstly, Martin, Canada is in the middle of an election campaign, and the public broadcaster is trying to tackle a wave of fake news. But how's it doing it?
That's right. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, CBC, is very concerned that fake news reports are not only going to perhaps distort the election campaign, but also like poison the whole news environment in the country. And this has been backed up by a poll that was conducted in Canada that showed about 90% of Canadians admit that they have fallen for fake news stories, usually from social media and quite often from Facebook, they say. So what they've come up with is a chatbot, which is, it's a type of software where you can basically, with one click on the website, you can speak to a fact checker at CBC, or at least have a text exchange with them to verify whether the story you've seen is true or not. And the chatbot goes a bit further. If you look deeper into it, there is a course there that you can go on, which will turn you into a fake news spotter yourself. It will show you how to see whether images have been altered, verify whether news websites are genuine or not. And in a very up-to-date move, they also show you how to spot deep fakes, which are these videos, you know, where they've changed the face of somebody or the words they're saying in a video, usually in the political sphere, in an attempt to misrepresent them.
On to Mexico, where Ernestina Diaz is proud to have completed her primary school education. So what makes her different from millions of other students?
Well, there are two things. First of all, Ernestina Diaz is 81 years old, and she's studied for her primary school education in her local Institute of Adult Education in Chihuahua State. And the second thing is that she belongs to the Tarahumara community, who are indigenous Mexicans. They live in the high mountains of northern Mexico. And like a lot of indigenous people, their literacy rates are really quite low, both in Spanish, but also in their own native language. And in the case of Tarahumara, this is a language that's closely related to the one that was spoken in the Aztec Empire, which ruled central Mexico before the Spanish conquest. And these institutes exist in many states, and they really do try to get literacy rates through to indigenous people. The Ministry of Education decided to tweet a picture of Ernestina Diaz holding up her certificate, and this became something of a social media sensation in Mexico. And there's been a bit of a follow-up, which is that Ernestina plans to go on to secondary education now, and back in her home village she intends to use this knowledge and share it with her community.
And finally, a Russian city's got itself into a bit of a mess after enlisting death in a road safety campaign. Who thought that was a good idea?
Well, many people in the city of Arkhangelsk in the far north are asking the same question. The idea was that there's an accident black spot, and if you put a big wooden statue of Death, the Grim Reaper, with skull, black shroud, holding a scythe, and a sign saying, observe the speed limit, that will discourage drivers from speeding. A lot of people in the city have reacted with horror. They think this is in awfully bad taste. You know, some people may have died at this spot and you're putting up a statue of death. Other people say, you know, this terrifying image is more likely to drive people off the road than save lives. And just to make things worse for the council, the day after they put it up, somebody stole it. They turned up in a tow truck, loaded it and drove off. Local people passing by thought, oh, it's the council taking it away. Now, the police have actually found it. It was dumped over a fence. And the council have decided to, you know, double down on this. They're actually going to put it on a mobile base, move it around the city. And so whenever there's anywhere where there's, you know, an accident hotspot, they'll put it there to warn people. So I don't think we've seen the last of the Grim Reaper of Arkhangelsk.
Martin, thank you very much indeed. Martin Morgan from BBC Monitoring with news from elsewhere. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. And if you'd like to comment on this edition and the stories we chose to include, do drop us an email. We love hearing from you. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thank you for listening. And until next time, goodbye.